in the face of declining oil revenues, in the face of declining potential state participation.
Thanks, Gary. Roland Shanks.
Yeah, with fear of dwelling a little bit too much on the doom and gloom side, I think I'd like to run through some numbers that I've been playing with. Just kind of thinking about it, a fictitious village that might lie near a large metropolitan area in the state where land values are high. Lots typically sell from $40,000 to $50,000 for a residential building lot. This fictitious village might have about 127 members. When you start looking at an entitlement of 100,000 acres of land, which, you know, conservatively is maybe worth $100 million on the books as far as an asset goes, you start looking at an individual asset of the stockholders of about $800,000. You start looking at a price for that share of stock based on that value, which, you know, there's lots of market influences, and maybe they're looking at what they've received in the past as far as income and what they expect to receive in the future as far as income. So maybe you say that the stock value is worth approximately one-fifth of the book value, of the per capita value. And you start looking at the fact that it takes about 65 members to take control of that corporation. And you end up with a final number of about $10 million to fund, you know, an attempt to take over a corporation like that. Then when you go to the bankers and you lay this whole scenario out for them and you start talking about what kind of leverage they might give you on some money, you start talking about some very low figures to start a scenario like that. As far as there was a lot of talk earlier about who might lead a takeover like that, well, I can think of several leading citizens in Anchorage who might be interested in leading a takeover like that, especially with an end prize of that size. So I think we are talking about, particularly in some areas of the state, a very real scenario when we start talking about takeovers. There are areas of the states where I don't think that a takeover of village corporations is probably, you know, in the near future. And I think there are areas of the state where the traditional bonds to the land and the traditional bonds to the village center are strong enough that they would turn back any takeover of that sort. But we also have to look at the changing nature of our villages and the fact that youngsters are leaving the villages, that the shares are being dispersed from their original stockholders down through inheritance and death and passing on to new generations, to a broader base of shareholders who have different expectations than some of the original shareholders did. So I think when you start looking at numbers like that, especially when you work for a corporation like that, you have to start planning. Because realistically, a corporation like that is not going to be able to come up with the cash flow to turn back any kind of serious takeover attempt. And you might turn it back the first time, but you'd surely never turn it back the second time. I guess I just wanted to add a little bit that, you know, we can talk about esoteric, you know, what-if scenarios, but there are some corporations in this state who have already started to put the numbers together and have already started to look at, you know, essentially what we're going to have to do as far as defense plans go. When you take these same kind of figures and play them off a regional corporation, there's some of the regional corporations that would be I could see being very interesting too for certain multinational corporations who have interest in those fields. I guess I just wanted to, you know, a lot of people have been saying, well, this is probably still pie in the sky. I guess I just wanted to bring it back to reality that I can see several candidates, and going through the numbers, I can see where you don't even have to look outside for our potential takeover scenarios. We can look right here in the state of Alaska.
Yeah, Glenn Fredericks, and then Chris McNeil.
We have a million acres that we hold, and we have 1,200 shareholders. That's 10,000 acres apiece. And if we turned around and sold it to the state for $100 an acre, we'd be pretty wealthy people. Give us the constitutional right to hunt and fish, and I think that's what the natives want and have always wanted. we don't really know how to hold land. We never have. My dad never had a title in his life. Western society has ingrained us to this thing. But, you know, if you take a million acres and turn around for the state or for the government, and just in our area, give us the Constitution. I always thought that we made a mistake as natives. We should have put our hunting and fishing rights in the state constitution. And that's why we have our subsistence laws trying to change all the time. It would take the whole state. I think that's a mistake. We did that, I think, in the Constitution of the United States. But talking about the other stuff, I think there's a way right today that this corporations, I don't worry too much about 1991 myself. I think there's other ways we could survive. One is separation of land and money. I really believe in my mind that United States Congress, we settled for two things, two big things. One was the land and one was the money. The money I got is the shares I own right today, not the land value. I haven't put any value to that land, and I don't intend to. And it'll take years and years just to try to figure out how you're going to evaluate the land anyhow. But I keep saying to myself that if there is a way, and we are studying this proposal and going to go into more in-depth, is separation of the land. Put it into another corporation, association, co-op, something. And then you have the shares, the money that we now got from the federal government. That would become the shares we're talking about in 1991. And who in their right mind would want to buy that then, you know, if you separate the land? You can do it, I think, today. I think there's ways. Co-op is one way that State Alaska has that, and there's no dissenters' rights. Why we say we don't want dissenters' rights? Because we got to have time to evaluate, I think, our property. If there's dissenters, then we'll have to sit back and try to evaluate, and we'll come to all kinds of lawsuits, I believe. But co-op, I believe there, and these are the things we're going to study and give our people the option. I think there's a way we could separate that land. Then what do you do when, after you separate it, you want to go into business? You go to your land company and identify, say, 1,000 acres of timber. Take that acreage out by lease, some kind of lease agreement for 100 years, and it would revert back to the association or co-op when we depleted or used up the resource. At the same time, I believe that company or that corporation, timber corporation, can issue stocks to the same people that the same shareholders that I have, 1,220 of them. I also believe that this new company can issue shares to the kids born after 71. There's nothing in the law that says we can't do that. Only law that says that is the stock of the 71 stuff, 71 stock. But if I made a corporation today, I think I can issue stocks, maybe not 100% stock, to the kids that were born after 71. I say the way to do it is to separate that land. If there isn't a way, then we ought to find out how we could change that law, either in state statutes or go to Congress. I personally don't feel very good about going to Congress and try to change things, because we always get everybody's opinion. We don't get what we want. But I think to deal with the state is more efficient, myself. But those are some of my thoughts. And what I'm doing, for your information, is compiling all this stuff and see which way is the best way to do it. All the people that I work for out there, 1,220 shareholders say, keep that land at all costs. And my job then becomes to find a way, some way, to keep that land, if that's what they want, you know? Then, and that's my job, and I think one way is to look at the corporate structure of the state of Alaska. If there is, could be separated, you know, by, with our bylaws, I think today we can separate that, because we as corporate officers and people that deal with the corporate have already separated big amount of cash, you know, when we buy something, we already separated stock, you know. So I think it could work, you know. By the people, majority of the people have to vote on this, and they're the people that own that stock. I think it can be done right today.
Yeah, thanks, Glenn. I think we should return to that subject. Chris McNeil.
Can you hear me? I wanted to focus for a second on the question of individual behavior in the sale of stocks, because I think it's important, especially if there were no impediments to the sale of stock after 1991. I think there's a strong suggestion that there are a lot of normative beliefs out there wherein shareholders now believe that it's important for cultural and many other reasons not to sell the stock. At Sea Alaska, we had done a survey a couple years back, and I don't think there's any question that there are at least some cracks in that theory. When shareholders were asked whether or not they would sell the stock, most of the shareholders answered very emphatically that no, they wouldn't. It was only 1 or 2%, I think, that said that they would do that. But when they were asked what they thought their neighbor would do, then the percentages went way up. I think you're starting to look at the 20% range. When that occurred, I think even at that point that, you know, there may be some real variance in behavior as to what people actually do and what they may say they do. There's also, it seems to me there's been the suggestion that there is a long-term value out insofar as maintaining the ownership of stock, both as to the inherent ownership interest and as to the potential of mergers. It seems to me that there is a case being made right now, certainly in this administration, that in fact mergers are good for the economy. They grease the skids of the economy. In fact, I think there are some work being done in the SEC to prevent the anti-repellent measures that you know that have been adopted by some corporations because the. Argument, I guess, is that, in fact, that's not good for the shareholders or the corporations, and it's just a dissipation of assets. I don't believe all that, but it's a case that, in fact, is being made. I think what maybe is really quite important is a kind of a maybe a conceptual inconsistency insofar as the ownership of the stock is concerned, because after 1991, that stock to a great extent will become money in the bank as opposed to a piece of paper that's filed in a drawer someplace or left. And I think what you have, will have, is not really a question of greed or even a question of choice. It's really a question of the economics of the situation so far as an individual is concerned. It seems to me that the theory of stock ownership is at least is predicated on some assumption that you have some surplus value or capital in order to be able to make the investment in the first place. In this case, there was a trade of a vast amount of rights in order to obtain that interest. But after 1991, you have a situation where people will have money, and it seems to me that you have to have money to keep money in the bank, or you have to be able to have some level of surplus in order to sustain that investment, if you want to think of it in terms of an investment. And I think this is really critical, because in my view, you can draw a demographic map of this state, and it seems to me that what you would find is sales that are made by people, not really because of choice, but because of a need, because there is a need in order to sustain a living. And I think that in some sense it belies the idea that there really is choice. I look at that really as more of an involuntary situation rather than one where people actually affirmatively decide that they're going to sell the stock. And one of the other sides of this too is, of course, if things go as they are, the judgment proof element of that stock also evaporates. And it strikes me as if I were a creditor, I would certainly be looking at my whole card insofar as trying to make a collection on any debts that may be past due. And it seems to me that all of these things are fairly important in thinking about it, because I think it focuses a little bit more attention away from the idea that it's just a question, a pure question of what people will want to do or what they think they'll want to do, rather than a question of what they will do based upon being able to survive. Because you really can't eat belief, and you can't feed yourself with belief. And I think that those questions will become increasingly important. The other thing that I was thinking about here as the discussion has gone on in talking about mergers and forces external to the corporation is that it seems to me that one of the things that 1991 does is that it created kind of an immediate focus on survival, because I think there's a great deal of concern that there would be sales and loss of control. But it seems to me that there has to be maybe a bit more focus on what shareholders and the owners of the corporation believe to be the objectives of 1991, objectives of the Claim Settlement Act itself, using the 1991 really more as a focus. And it seems to me that there are a number of objectives out there, some of which there in fact is some debate about, and that those debates really aren't always in focus. For my own part, I really think that ANCSA was meant to create some level of long-term ownership, and with that, some long-term benefit. And it seems to me that if you get there, whatever you create has to have some kind of productivity to it, otherwise the benefits will not accrue. One of the other objectives, it seems to me, that has been discussed here is a question of self-determination, which is comes out in the form of talking about control of the institutions that you created, and talking, although it hasn't been voiced here, the question of sovereignty insofar as self-government is concerned, and human resource development. And then in addition to that, it seems to me that these institutions and shareholders also have enunciated a great deal of interest in being able to maintain and sustain culture and other normative objectives. And when you get around to looking at these kinds of things, it seems to me in some part that the AFN, some of the AFN recommendations maybe are a little ambivalent on, for example, the issue of ownership. And it seems to me that there is a split in some way in analyzing the issue of ownership and control, because I think people have discovered that you don't need total ownership to continue control, and that cuts all kinds of different directions. So I don't know where it really takes you, but I think that at least those two concepts have to be separated, because I really think the question of long-term ownership and the distribution of wealth is a very key one here insofar as 1991 itself is concerned.
Thanks, Chris. Ralph Johnson.
It seems to me that in a simple world, one can divide the Native community into two groups. And I do this hypothetically because the world never quite divides in such simple lines. But there are those who wish to sell and who wish to assimilate, or who are assimilated in the larger culture, who decide to live in San Francisco, Los Angeles, Seattle, or whatever, take their money, invest in different things, go to the Bahamas, do what lots of other folks do from time to time. And to those people, except for their cultural memory of being an Alaska Native or a descendant of an Alaska Native, the retention of land is not of great importance. On the other hand, if we take the scenario that Jack Taylor has mentioned, let's look at 2011, and let's ask the question, how many of the Native people still live on the land? I don't mean by choice or by otherwise, but because of all kinds of circumstances, they still live on the land. They live there, and let me play the part now of a government decision maker who is worried about how much money is going to be paid out in welfare payments, and how many poor people will there be in the United States, what is the general welfare of the nation, how rich will the country be in cultural diversity. At that point, around the year 2000, I'm going to look at the Natives who still live on the land and who now don't own the land, and I'm going to realize that they're worse off. Their culture has been damaged, their economic opportunity has been damaged. And so to those people who wish to live on the land or who are required to live on the land by cultural choice or economic necessity, it's really critical that they not lose the land and lose that future opportunity. It isn't as if they are going to decide, now having lost the land, we'll all move to Florida. There are all kinds of reasons that many people will not move to Florida or somewhere else. They're going to stay there. So when I look to 2011, those people are still on the land. It's critical that the nation as a whole make that land an asset that can be developed. Even though it's minimal, it certainly is a lot better than living there without the land. Now, one other point, and that is that if it is entirely feasible for those who wish to remain on the land to sell, they may sell either out of a misunderstanding of what the consequences of that sale would mean, and I call forth the experience of the allotment process in the lower 48 where people didn't understand that and over a period of 1887 to 1934 lost about two-thirds of the land and were worse off because of that. They were simply worse off. They may have had some cash for a little bit, but they were worse off. Or these people may sell because they urgently need cash at a given moment, some temporary emergency. Well, I suspect that in that situation there should be some protection against the loss of that land because their future and their children's future, not by choice, but because of cultural demand or imperative, will be that they will remain on the land. So it seems to me that you have those two groups of people, those who wish to assimilate or go elsewhere, to which a sale provides cash and an economic opportunity, the Adam Smith kind of opportunity to go and buy and sell other stock or other land, and the second group who in fact will remain on the land and for whom that is very important that the land remain in their possession or in their right.
David Case.
Kind of following up on that, Ralph, and a couple other things that have been mentioned. Maybe I was relieved to find out that 50% of the village corporations would still be left. Is that what you thought, even in the worst case scenario? That's 100 villages. What would those villages, maybe you wouldn't even know this, I mean, I don't know how deep your crystal ball is, but what would account for the survival of those villages? I mean, what would they have some kind of land holdings that would be different from the villages that didn't survive? Would there be anything that in general distinguishes them from the villages that didn't survive, the village corporations that didn't survive as landowners?
Yeah, unfortunately, I guess in our analysis of that, it was our feeling that those 100 villages really would represent fewer corporations because they were probably the villages who had banded together in a cooperative effort or in a joint effort where they had pooled their assets. Our numbers of looking at how many would not survive was typically based on those who stayed alone. And so the smaller, probably the less chance of survival.
Okay. I have a couple of questions, because it seems to me that often the issue of whether the land is at risk really might come down to what kind of land are we talking about. If it is tundra, isolated tundra, and leaving apart the subsurface value, if any, then I'm assuming that that's not too attractive as a takeover asset that is desired by a takeover company. Is that a correct assumption? Okay. Why not?
Well, one of the areas that Tom asked about is who would be interested in a takeover? Well, let's put it this way. If you were to put into the newspaper in the lower 48, almost any newspaper, buy 100,000 acres of northern Alaska. Cheap. All you got to do is get a little leverage at the bank. Hunting, fishing, beautiful scenery. It'd sell.
Okay. So even the value of the land for its hunting and fishing.
I think there's so many other values.
Around to commercial value.
I think there's so many other commercial values besides resource development. Mm-hmm. That small villages with tundra land are going to look economically nice to some group, someplace.
A lot of dentists in the lower 48 with money to burn.
You know, we found in the lower 48, in Wyoming as an example. I come off of a ranch family in Wyoming, and I grew up looking out there at that rolling, grassy nothing and saying, my God, who wants this besides a cow? I don't. They're now selling that for thousands of dollars an acre for people who want to live out there.
Well, so is your conclusion then that really what makes the difference between the corporations that survive or villages that survive as withholding land is the structure that they have assumed, the corporate structure?
Yes, that was our basis. We felt that those corporations who got together, who banded together, who had more management talent, more assets, were in a stronger position to be able to maneuver and not be picked off first.
Right. Okay. Could I, just before we go on, there's something that I wanted to ask, maybe I could ask Elizabeth Johnson about it. It's about Alaskan state corporate law. This is a stupid question, but someone has to have the nerve to ask the stupid questions. If you have a buyback provision and you buy back shares from your shareholders, that is, suppose Bristol Bay Regional Corporation buys back shares, then those shares simply go into the treasury, do they? And nobody can vote those shares.
That is correct. They could be reissued.
Could be reissued.
Yeah, depending on what the total view is of, you know, do we have restricted stock or not? But
so they are just, they go back into the treasury and they are unissued share capital. I had another question if I could find it here. The corporations such as Bristol Bay are the only corporations now, given the restrictions on the sale of shares. You are the only native corporations are the only corporations in Alaska that can't issue shares to raise money.
That is my understanding.
And after 1991, in addition to having shareholders who might go around selling shares, your board of directors could vote to issue shares from the treasury to double the number of shares.
Sure, and I think that whole business of raising money is one of the concerns that corporate management has to evaluate, the recognition that if native control is important, and remember I'm saying if, only in the context of the sentence, not that I do not think that native control is important, but if you value native control, which leads some to the conclusion that restricted stock is an extremely important route to pursue, then you must recognize that there is a price to be paid for it, and the price to be, one of the prices, in addition to dealing with Congress, another price to be paid for it is the lack of ability to raise funds in that way, unless you were to crank that in somehow too with a different type of stock issue. And the question would be, if you did, then who would be interested in buying it if they had no impact on control? You see, in economic terms, there's really no real alternative there, I think.
Nobody could acquire equity in the company.
Yeah, I mean, if you really tried to, on one hand, pursue naive control, on the other hand, tried to pursue a mechanism by which you could raise equity or some other type of financing, say preferred shares, who would invest it? It would have to be in a corporation, and I can think of only one at present, that had a strong history of very strong management and very strong earnings to be able to swing both worlds.
But to go back to what you said this morning, you are convinced that in order to keep native control of native corporations, the only sure answer is to restrict the sale of shares after 1991, and you would therefore say that they shouldn't have the power to issue shares from the Treasury to the bank or mortgage company?
That would be my conclusion, yes.
Yeah, Gary Anders?
I ask a couple of questions with regard to some of the issues that have been brought up in the readings that I've seen. And that deals with special benefit programs for the new natives and for the elders. With regard to stock or the different kinds of ideas that have been raised in creating special stock certificates for new natives, it seems to me that you're really not changing the asset base of the corporation. As a matter of fact, when you double the number of shares, you're creating more shareholders and distributing a fixed size pie in terms of the overall dividends to many more people than before, and that would create quite a bit of controversy at the village level and probably at the regional level. I don't know the answer to this, but it seems like there are built-in mechanisms that could be of a cultural nature in dealing with special classes of shareholders. By that, I mean, I heard Rosita talk this morning about the vitality and the strength of Native family bonds, of community patterns that have been in existence for a long time. When we look at these communal values and talk about them, it seems that implicit in the way people behave would be an attempt to utilize dividends or income derived from a corporation to make special efforts to accommodate the needs of older people. And I'm wondering if, in fact, the idea of creating different classes of stock or issuing new stock is a plausible one.
I hope you're not asking me that question. Did you follow that, Elizabeth?
I think I've, well, Monroe, would you like to go with it?
I wouldn't mind talking about it in the context of what you said and what Tom said about restricted stock. So let me ask you this kind of question. This is a roundabout way of answering this. Could it be conceivable for Bristol Bay or a corporation to say, let's take certain assets that we now hold that, let's say, are subsistence lands or some other subset of assets of the corporation, and put those in a corporation in which the stock will be restricted, put other assets in a corporation in which stock will not be restricted. So that you look at your asset base or your total assets and say, to what extent is this a question of all or nothing? Or is there an issue here in terms of saying, what are the assets that need to be controlled? What is it over which native control must be maintained? And then as to other assets, have a different form of pursuit.
Let me do a subset under that then. When people talk about, let's take the assets and split them into different categories, it raises two questions in my mind. And at Monroe, as you were addressing, at least that you covered some of them. One is that if you're going to take, at least under Alaska state corporate law, as you know, if you're going to take assets and start moving them around, and particularly when you're talking about land, which I think most of us would feel would be something that not only arguably, but I will now use a word that a lawyer doesn't use, I will use the word morally, should be taken to shareholder vote. Because if you're talking about many, at least in the Bristol Bay region, many of the village corporations, I think there's no question as a matter of law that that land is all or substantially all of the corporation's assets. So there's no question but that under state law, if you're going to start moving things around, you're going to have to go to shareholder vote. In addition to going to shareholder vote and having a high standard of passage for that transaction to go forward, you are going to have dissenters' rights.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Just before you go on,
yes.
What do you mean high standard of passage?
Okay.
What does the law require?
Good. My memory is two-thirds. Is that your memory, Bart, that for something, for extraordinary events like the sale of all or substantially all, is a two-thirds standard? Now, I'm talking about the law as it is in present state statute. I'm not talking about how we could reconstruct, should we desire to. I'm talking what is. The third thing I think that should be mentioned under is you move assets, and again, Monroe, I know I'm carrying coals to Newcastle in your case, but is the dissenters' rights. And of course, dissenters' rights, although as Bart referred to it, are not always built into corporate law. Where they are built in, they were meant to balance rights out. The whole game is changing. You presently have a corporation with all of these assets wrapped together. Suddenly you're going to take, in our village's case, the major asset out and move it someplace else. If you're going to do that, what about the people who don't want to go along with that? Do you just say you can stick it in your ear, which is one of the expressions that I've heard being said around, who cares what the minority wants? Or do you go with the balance where you say, minorities have rights too. We will look to all our shareholders and look to what we accomplish and try to balance rights out. But under present state law, you would have to acknowledge and deal with dissenters' rights if you were going to move land out. At least, Monroe, in your example you gave, you explained something which nobody has ever bothered to explain to me, which is who it was you thought was going to own this new entity. Many times people keep talking about we're going to, you know, move the assets around, and they don't take the next step and say who's going to own that entity. And you'll see them drawing elaborate structures, and it will basically be, if I could, this won't be Bristol Bay's case, but if Bristol Bay were to move the land out someplace else, and it would often be Bristol Bay that would then be the parent corporation. So if somehow the parents attack, so is the subsidiary. You know, really nothing has been accomplished except everybody says, aha, we've separated the assets out. It's accomplished nothing. In the circumstance you gave, you definitely accomplished more than that.
Well, I guess, I was then, Monroe, yeah. Could you go back and tell us what your example is that was so clever, because it passed me by.
I'm not sure it's so clever. It was really in response to your question to Elizabeth, which was, is the only way to maintain native control to restrict stock?
Yeah.
And I guess I was asking the question, the answer to that may be yes, if you were asking the question, maintain control over what? That is to say, you could look at you use the term 44 million acres. That's probably not the assets of Alaska Native Corporations. There's money, there's deals, there's land, there are a variety of things that are a mix of things. any particular corporation might look at that mix and say, here is where it's important to maintain control. This is aside from the question of who asks that question and who answers the question, but just in the abstract, what kinds of control is necessary over what kinds of assets? And then then the question would be answered differently. That's really what I was really trying to say, is there an example one could think of in which a corporation might say, yes, we must maintain control and we must restrict the sale of stock, but not over everything which is currently under restricted stock ownership. Now, the reason that's an important question with respect to Mr. Anders' question is you could take some assets of a corporation and say, this is for elders. An entity can make, aside from state law and federal law questions, which I'm putting aside for the moment, because I think those are actually conceptually addressable and politically addressable. The question is whether you want to. You could say, all right, X corporation has $50 million in assets. $10 million should be used for elders, and that is not subsistence land, that is marketable stock or certificates of deposit or joint ventures with somebody or other, et cetera, that ought to be segregated out. It's not subsistence land, it's not X, it's not Y. What we want to do with that asset is segregate it and use it for elders, use it for education, or use it for speculative opportunities to opt out. So it seems to me that, and then that doesn't foreclose non-corporate solutions as to the remainder.
Well,
so that's the answer to. I mean, that's what I was saying.
I'm not any farther ahead. You go ahead
okay.
And see what it.
Let me just. I'll get off law, which should be a relief to us all, and I won't be stuck for malpractice. What struck me, Monroe, about what you're saying is this: that as I think over the balance sheets of the corporations with which I'm familiar, which is obviously not 220, but a much smaller group. When you think about taking all of the things we've talked about, who wants to take over, what they would pay for it, has to do with a group of people, and as Roland says, he can think of a few that are located right here in Alaska, who would have both the motives and the wherewithal to do this. But it's because they would be taking the assets and using them for a totally different purpose than the native community may want to use them for. That the value of subsistence would hardly be one of the values that you would be willing to purchase these lands for. Okay, and that's of course where the wealth is created, the wealth in our scheme, in the dominant society's view of what wealth is. On the other hand, you have some of the corporations because of where they're located, because of the mix of their shareholders, who said, no, we want this land for subsistence. Now, where that's going on, and the basic asset left in that corporation is the land, talking about, you can talk about setting the land aside and restricting the stock, but for that kind of corporation I'm describing, splitting it out doesn't accomplish anything. It's the restriction that accomplishes it. It's really very few of the native corporations that fit the description you're talking about, where you have a cluster of a tremendous cluster of assets, where you have the land that might be treated in one way and some of these other major, already wealthy economic assets that might be treated another way. That, I don't think, is the major case. The major case is, at least for the bulk of the village corporations, is land that is either going to be taken over by other people where, it's bought for pennies per acre and then turned into the kind of wealth the dominant society views as wealth, or it's going to be utilized for subsistence, and that's just a question of control. But there's no wealth there in the dominant society sense that you can then translate into something for elders unless you take that land out of being used for subsistence.
Let me ask a question, and that is, let's assume for the moment that most village corporations, the major asset of most village corporations is land, and most or all of that land is needed for subsistence purposes. Would you trade the opportunity for a restriction, well, on the land? Let me put it, let me see how I want to put this. Would you say that stock could be restricted or land could be frozen, but only if the land is maintained for subsistence purposes? That is to say, you can't have restricted stock in assets which can be used for non-subsistence purposes. Or generally speaking,
I wouldn't, because I know, first of all, Bristol Bay shareholders are for restricted stock, the majority of them. Second of all, Bristol Bay Native Corporation owns so little surface that for me to talk meaningfully about Bristol Bay setting aside anything for subsistence, you know, doesn't make any sense.
I'm talking about the villages. Is what's being suggested here that it's important to maintain restrictions because it's important to maintain subsistence. If Congress then said, we'll accept that as a package, is that a suitable objective?
It might be for the villages, but I don't think it would be for the regions.
I'm talking about the villages. I think, and
I'm not from the village. So, Glenn, can you respond to that?
I say restricted. If Congress goes along with the restriction, then definitely, you know. I mean, I think that's what we're all going for.
Well, Glenn, just to make sure I understand this, the suggestion is that a village corporation whose principal asset is land might seek to have its stock restricted in perpetuity, but that if you had a corporation that had other assets besides land, it would only be as to the ownership of the land that sale of stock would be restricted. That's where I fall off the wagon here, because I don't quite understand how you have some stock restricted and other stock not restricted unless you have two separate corporate entities.
That's what Monroe is suggesting. Yeah,
you can have